Welcome to Conversations on the Runway, the Australian Air Force's podcast series. Through a series of episodes, we vector in leading thinkers and professionals for a conversation targeting key areas of air and space power, the physical and virtual domains, the strategy, the technology, the challenges, and the people bringing it all together. Today's episode is part of our Space Power series with host Michael Veach. So grab a brew and tune in to today's conversation on the runway.
Welcome to the final in this series of Conversations on the Runway, the space episodes, perhaps the lost in space episodes. No, I have promised my boss I will not draw yet another ludicrously long science fiction bow to the current realities of space. Although I haven't mentioned the Thunderbirds. And later in the show, we will be delving into a potential space emergency scenario that may involve the International Rescue Team, but will definitely see Australia playing a major part. And it's a story not, in fact, too far removed from reality, as our esteemed guest, Professor Russell Boyce, will illustrate. What have we learned over this series of podcasts? Well, space is big, obviously, but so is its potential for advancing mankind, both on this rock and potentially others. Hence, we are using space in ways right now utterly unimaginable a few decades ago when we first went up there. Our dependency on space is increasing exponentially, and so, therefore, is its vulnerability, making space, as one general put it, the ultimate high ground of any future conflict. We are, we learned already, talking about human settlement on the moon and even Mars, and many stakeholders, nations, corporations, academics, engineers and educators are taking it very seriously indeed. Diversity in space, we learned, means that it's no longer just blokes with crew cuts and names like Chip and Todd sewn onto their spacesuits that will get up there. And the industry generally worldwide is continuing to open up for women and other clever people from all sorts of nations and backgrounds. And that surely is a good thing. The lines between government and commercial uses of space are rapidly breaking down. And the laws to govern this vacuum, pun intended, could not be written fast enough, even if stakeholders could agree on those laws and even who should be writing them. The UN can and does have a great deal to say on regulating space, but is anyone listening? More than once I describe space as the Wild West of the 21st century, and more than once our eminent guests agreed, which I found rather startling. Space is full of junk, it seems, and is only going to get worse. Satellites are, some of them, the size of a loaf of bread and can be put up there to do more with less money by an increasing array of countries and corporations. Where, however, does Australia stand in all this? We had a whole episode devoted to that too and learned that we did indeed have a space industry, then we lost it. Can we get it back again? On our final episode of this series, the space series of Conversations on the Runway, we talk about some of the most exciting things we are doing in space today and ask what for Australia lies ahead. Professor Russell Boyce has a good deal to say about an Australian space future. He leads the University of New South Wales Canberra space research effort, at which venerable institution he is also chair for intelligent space systems. Add to this the 25 years, gosh, he hardly looks old enough, Russell Boyce has worked in the breathtaking arena of hypersonics research, in which he also finds himself chair at the University of Queensland. Executive Counsel of the Space Industry Association of Australia, yada, 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 the only Australian Fellow of the American Institute for Aeronautics and Astronautics. Honestly, I'm just going to have to put a biro through the rest of Russell's qualifications and achievements, as simply listing them will devour our entire show. Russell, welcome to Conversations on the Runway.
Thank you, Michael.
I'm going to be asking big things of you today because I'm hoping you're going to bend my brain a bit as we take apart a particularly tricky international space emergency scenario in which Australia will, you tell me, play a part, albeit imaginary, and we're even going to, sort of war game it a bit, or at least, you know, Dungeons and Dragons it a bit. But first, the utterly tantalising fields that you are working in, have worked in, building an Australian space future, both practically and educationally. Let's start with hypersonics. Just a thumbnail, please. Am I thinking, Russell, London to Melbourne in 40 minutes, that sort of thing, or is my imagination once again running away with me?
Michael, that's slightly too fast for hypersonics.
Oh, I hate the long-haul plane trips, so, you know, I was hoping you could cut a bit of time off the trip to London.
Well, if you were on the International Space Station, you would do London to Sydney in about 40 minutes.
Right.
That is about the right time. It takes 45 minutes to do half a lap of the Earth in low Earth orbit. But hypersonics, on the other hand, hypersonics is the art of flying very, very, very fast in the Earth's atmosphere. And a typical hypersonic future application will be traveling at about 8 times the speed of sound. We call that Mach 8. And at Mach 8, how far would you get in 45 minutes? That would be approximately Johannesburg to Perth. So it's still cranking along pretty fast.
Supersonics on steroids was one description I read, but where is in supersonics, which has a definite speed ceiling? I believe hypersonics, it's slightly more open. Is that correct?
It's the distinction between supersonic flight and hypersonic flight is quite nebulous. Some people say it's at Mach 8. Some people say it's at Mach 4, Mach 5, Mach 6. In actual fact, the difference between the two is when it gets really, really hard for the engineer. So your military listeners, for example, would know well there are supersonic aircraft in service. That's quite a tractable engineering problem to be able to develop those aircraft. Hypersonics is where the temperatures involved start to melt the aircraft, the materials that are needed. You need to get to very, very exotic high-temperature ceramics or very, very sophisticated layers of different types of materials to be able to handle that. And depending on the application.
For insulation purely, I mean, in layman's terms, to keep the heat of the friction of the air you're moving through out of the interior of the hypersonic craft.
That's right. So, for example, the hypersonic flight experiments that I've been involved in 5 to 10 years ago, we would do a Mach 8 experiment and it would be in the Earth's atmosphere. We would have just a few seconds before the aluminium and steel structure of the experiment would literally start to melt and fall apart.
In what situations were these experiments conducted? Tell me about them.
Well, some of your listeners may remember the HiShot program, which was a program initiated by the University of Queensland that evolved into what was known as the HiFire flight experiment program, conducted jointly by Australia's Defence Science and Technology Group and the US Air Force's Air Force Research Laboratories, and also participation by the University of Queensland and others. Imagine creating, for example, a scramjet test, putting it onto the top of a two-stage sounding rocket, launching from somewhere like Woomera, or in the case of the campaign that I led in the Scram Space program, launching from a rocket range north of the Arctic Circle in Norway, attempt to get that rocket up into space, not into an orbit, because then it will just keep going around the Earth, but up to about 300, 400 kilometres altitude. And as it drops back into the atmosphere, it reaches the speed that you need at just the right altitude that you need to do that flight experiment. But as I said, you only get a few seconds before it bites the dust.
Just remind us what SCRAM is. I've heard that term before. Can you give us a thumbnail on that, please, Russell?
SCRAM is supersonic combustion ram. Mm-hmm.
So I've heard of ramjet. Ramjets have been around since the Second World War. The German flying bombs were ramjets, weren't they? This is a further development from that probably very primitive technology.
Yes and no. The German technologies were very sophisticated, but they were pulse detonation engines. But certainly ramjet engines were in service very early on after the Second World War. A scramjet is an air-breathing engine that has no moving parts, and the airflow, in fact, the mixture of air and fuel in that engine is supersonic all the way through, from inlet through to exit. That's a very special collection of physics and chemistry that does wonderful things for you in terms of being able to fly at very high speed, but it comes with some very, very peculiar challenges, which mean the world is still working on that technology.
let's nod to the military defense heritage of Conversations on the Runway, Russell. Is hypersonic primarily a military application or civil or a blend?
There's a number of ways that that could be answered, but the most likely future application of hypersonic technologies would be military. And the reason I say that is that the most likely way that we will get hypersonics to work is in hypersonic vehicles or craft that stay at a constant speed. They cruise at around about the Mach 6 to Mach 8 speed. Mm-hmm. That, you know, it's not very far to step from that to a missile application.
Is the Blackbird the fastest aircraft, I think, still in the world, isn't it? The Great American Reconnaissance Bird, is that a hypersonic aircraft or a supersonic?
It's very high speed supersonic. Mm-hmm. I forget the exact speed. I think it was about Mach 3.5.
That rings a bell too. I was going to say it's about the 3 mark, but doesn't quite qualify into the hypersonic range.
No, although it was starting to get tough from an engineering perspective. I know that the fuel tanks would leak when it was sitting on the runway. It needed the aircraft to actually heat up once it was at full flight speed for everything to pull together and be nice and tight and sound.
Are these the sort of engineering conundrums that the team you're working with are dealing with hypersonic crafts?
Well, these days, no. So my former team, my former life, if you like, in hypersonics, yes, we were very concerned about the heating. We were very concerned about the complexities of getting a scramjet engine to work at all. We were hoping to be able to do that for access to space, to be able to launch satellites into orbit. My conclusion was that's unlikely to be what we'll use hypersonics for. It's just simply too hard, and that's probably a conversation for another day. But these days, my team developed satellites, and in particular, intelligence satellites.
I'd like to talk about another area you've been involved with, Russell, space situational awareness, SSA. The science, from what my modestly science brain takes it, is ensuring space objects don't bump into one another. Why is this a specialised field of scientific knowledge? I would have thought it was sort of elementary navigation or something like that.
One would think that a satellite or even a piece of space junk orbiting the Earth is just up there in a very, very predictable orbit. But it's not, and that's because the space environment is very, very unpredictable. For example, in low Earth orbit, it's not a vacuum, and space objects are in a very rarefied, admittedly, but still an atmosphere. As they do laps at extremely high speed, Sydney to London in 45 minutes, they are constantly being hammered by air molecules, and that induces a drag. And that drag, or just like an aeroplane, if you have a strange shaped object, there'll be strange forces build up on that object in different directions.
So this area of orbit, you said, is not vacuum. It's what, sort of still partial vacuum, is it?
That's correct.
Oh, wow, there you go.
The atmosphere doesn't suddenly stop, although it drops away in an exponential-like rate. But in low Earth orbit, you very much have to worry about neutral and charged particles. The charged particles make up what we call the ionosphere, which is actually an aspect of space situational awareness. Our JAWN over-horizon radar network uses the ionosphere to bounce radar waves over the horizon. So space objects orbit in that environment, and it fluctuates in time, and it gets very, very crazy whenever the sun gets active. So space weather drives what happens up there, and in fact, space weather can not only induce fluctuations in the behavior of satellite orbits, it can even take them out completely.
Heavens. So there are presumably uniquely qualified space meteorologists, I'm guessing, Russell, just for this. Space weather predicting sounds very important.
And that's actually part of Australia's very, very fine heritage. During World War II, we had radar specialists who found themselves looking for useful things to do with their skills after the war. That led to the establishment of ionospheric capabilities using radar, radio frequency physics in Australia. And out of that came an enormous heritage of Australian radio capabilities, including radio astronomy and in turn understanding of ionospheric physics and space weather. And we developed a thing called the Ionospheric Prediction Service, which is now part of the Bureau of Meteorology, and it's one of the finest space weather services globally.
I was going to ask, I'm going to ask a bit later, what are the areas that Australian space might move into extant from actually being up there, but that's one of them. Much of your work, Russell, is far from just being theoretical. I believe you're hoping to actually, or maybe have done, flown actual missions using real hardware in something called nanosat missions. What are they?
there's different sizes of satellites. The listeners would surely be aware of, well, the biggest satellite that's up there that man has made, the International Space Station. A more typical satellite is probably the size of a bus or maybe a car. But as you step down in scale, you end up with microsats, which are about the size of a washing machine, and then down to nanosats or typically CubeSats, which is what we play with. They could be the size of a shoebox or maybe a little bit larger, a book carton. You can go down to picosats. You can even go down to satellites on a chip, which are very, very small. And there's some funny stories that can be told about those. But yes, we work with nanosats.
Is this simply because, as with all technology, it just seems to get smaller? Cars, washing machines, why not chuck satellites in there? I mean, is it as simple as that?
That's very much part of the story. It is a simple message. There is a paradigm shift that has been taking place over the last decade, where the miniaturization of spacecraft using advances in electronics and the reduced cost of putting such a small satellite onto a rocket launch, which in turn has reduced the barrier to entry for countries, for organizations, even one case that I've heard of, a primary school, right, being able to get a very small object into orbit. It doesn't actually cost that much these days. Now, such satellites in the early part of that paradigm shift were just toys, a little bit gimmicky. Let's put an iPhone in space or let's just put something up there and say, hey, well, we've got something in orbit. Not very useful apart from educational purposes, which is actually an extremely important activity. But in terms of capability, not very useful. But that paradigm continues to change. Disruption continues to sweep across the space sector. And now we have the possibility, well, not the possibility, now we are starting to make advances on the early stages of intelligent constellations of many of these small, intelligent nano and microsats.
Yes.
And that is truly a game changer.
Wow. So you're outlining a situation where satellites are becoming smaller, cheaper, can do more, and are being put into orbits by an increasingly large and diverse array of players. No wonder something like space situational awareness is needed.
The US Air Force describe traditional large satellites as single point targets. It's easy to track them. It's easy to understand where they are. And if you wanted to perform a nefarious act on them, well within the bounds of possibility. As we move towards constellations of hundreds and even thousands of networked small spacecraft, which are able to act in intelligent ways, it becomes a very nebulous situation up there. And anecdotally, a former colleague or a colleague who used to be at DARPA, the US Blue Sky Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, mm-hmm. his comment to me was, with these future space capabilities, good luck to the adversary who can track them.
Yes,
because it's a very different proposition, and in fact, that also does worry the likes of the US Air Force, who lead the global effort to track space objects, to maintain the space object catalog, to predict collisions and to prevent space conflict from breaking out. The space is an ever-changing and increasingly complex situation.
And let's get to Australia's role in that situation. Just hypersonics and SSA are just two of the areas that you've worked in extensively, Russell. Let's get to the crux of it. Why does Australia potentially have a part to play in such fields as this? What makes us well-situated to go into these fields?
We have some interesting advantages. One of the advantages is that we have not been doing much in space, or in what the typical listener would consider to be space, as in technologies in orbit. We've not been doing much of that at all, while most of the rest of the world has been doing quite a bit. One might consider that to be a disadvantage, but actually we come baggage-free. We have a clean sheet of paper, and we are well-positioned to take advantage of the paradigm shift that I was describing before, and also well-positioned to play in the fringes or the crossover regions between space technology and other domains. And that's the sort of activity where true disruptive innovation can take place, which in turn can lead to opportunity. So, for example, it's not just about putting a satellite with an onboard sensor and a communication system into orbit. The future will include putting such satellites that also possess onboard artificial intelligence capabilities.
Mm-hmm.
They may well be quantum-enabled, they will be autonomous systems. In fact, they will be trusted autonomous systems. Australia has rich heritage and world leadership in those parallel and intersecting domains, which is a fabulous opportunity for us as a nation with that clean sheet of paper and with that rapidly evolving and shifting space paradigm to jump in and become a world leader in some niche areas.
Okay, I'm going to be an awful wet blanket here and give a reality check, and far be it for me to dwell on the negative, but one of the recurring themes we've discovered in this series of Conversations on the Runway, the space episodes from many eminent speakers such as yourself, Russell, is the story of opportunities lost in terms of our space industry going way back to, but not confined to, Woomera, the Cape Canaveral of the South, as one of them described that it could have been, lamenting. Russell, has anything changed in that field? Is anything changing? Car industry, medical research, manufacturing, renewable energies, one would hate to see space added to that litany of what might have been due to Australian, well, lack of leadership and lack of confidence is how I would put it. What's your thoughts on that?
I think we face the same risk today with the space industry. However, we're not 10 years down the track, regretfully looking in hindsight. We're at the beginning right now, and we do have the opportunity to avoid that risk. So what do I mean by that? I believe that if the Australian government, the space agency, defence, were to set about throwing money at developing an industry without thought for what is the difference between a space-capable industry, an industry that is technically skilled at doing what it does, just like the rest of the world, what's the difference between that and a potentially commercially successful space industry, noting that the rest of the world has been playing the game for a lot longer than us and are highly motivated to keep winning in that game, how is our young space industry going to commercially succeed? And I believe the answer to that is in those crossover activities, the combination of space and areas like artificial intelligence, in funding the sorts of push the boat out space activities where even if we make mistakes, and we probably will, we make them fast, we learn from them fast, and disruption comes. Creative, innovative ideas that can position Australian organisations to actually win in that game.
And surely, Russell, education, I mean, if the vagaries of government in industry, commitments to industry such as space remain difficult to determine, education for a space future remains a field perhaps that we can begin to establish. I know this has been the nature of much of your work. Do you think education is one of those cornerstones to an Australian space future?
Absolutely. Not just teaching the kids of today STEM subjects, and not just belaboring the old phrase that space is one of the two areas, space and dinosaurs are the two things that get kids inspired.
Yes.
Kids these days, young people these days have no need of inspiration. Young people these days, I'm quite astonished but excited at how deeply they think, how inspired they are, how much they want to change the world and have deep impact in very, very positive ways. Where I see education coming into that and the crossover with space is that space is not actually a discipline. It's not maths. It's not engineering. It's not science. Space is actually a domain, and that domain is very complex, and to successfully utilize it, to put technology into orbit, to derive information from it, to use that to solve problems, to do so responsibly, ethically, it requires all disciplines, and it requires complex thinking, and it requires leadership. So what I personally believe is that if we can bring kids into education focused on space, we have an opportunity not just to solve technological problems of the future, but to actually build the critical thinking future leadership that this country needs.
Well, what you've just said is completely in line with what we've discovered on this series. And to my delight, I have to say, some of the most erudite speakers on space have not been engineers, have not been scientists. They've been ethicists and historians, even archaeologists that we've had, people who have a very strong vision, not just for space, but for Australia in space. I know you do too. You've developed a master's program, which I believe is unique, and by which you're hoping to make Canberra a leading provider of a space education worldwide. Is that where one of our space future roles lies, Russell, not just as being space educated, but being Australia being space educators for the rest of the world?
Australia, one of our top export earners, is education. And as we come to this essentially a new area of activity for the country, and as we build expertise based on that clean sheet of paper and therefore creatively build expertise and new ways of thinking, and as we embrace not just the tech heads but also the historians and the ethicists and so on and so on, I think Australia and Australians will be building a level of understanding and perception and thinking about space which will be quite sought after globally. We have that opportunity, and it's within our grasp to create education programs to deliver that thinking. And given what we're seeing this year in particular with the with COVID, with the need to be embracing online delivery in more and more sophisticated ways, there's nothing preventing us, apart from ourselves, in global delivery of that capability.
The importance of space, as someone said, is not what's in space, but it's what's done with the information gained from space. You mentioned weather before, which I hadn't even thought of. Can you think of any other Indigenous space capabilities that we might be developing here? Not directly related to launching necessarily. And
one of the things Australia is actually known for around the world, because we haven't had space technology in orbit of our own, we've had to access other people's space systems and use the data that come from those. We've become extremely good at processing data from other people's space systems and not wedded to one particular space system. So Australia has a very, very thriving world-class downstream sector. By downstream, I mean the part of the space sector that is not the satellites in orbit, but it's the process of turning data into information for terrestrial outcomes. That can be for emergency management or environmental monitoring or for national security reasons. But whatever the purpose, we are extremely good at it, and that's where the money is, and that's where Australia's focus should actually be.
Let's see if we can harness this already existing industry that we have as an international education destination, unlike what we did a few decades ago with Australia being a nascent space subprime player, I'll say, when we had Rumo. Let's see if we can harness this. But Russell, we did, having put Australia at the forefront of the space race, let's present you with a scenario and some emergency, say, we can envisage pertaining to an Australian space industry of the future coming to the rescue, a la, as aforementioned, Thunderbird 3, the international, what I thought was going to be something like the International Space Station meets the International Rescue sort of thing. But as you pointed out to me beforehand, Russell, there are, in fact, other equally dramatic scenarios, but not nearly as far-fetched and not so welded to an as-yet imaginary future. And it starts, you pointed out to me before we came onto the show, a scenario evolving perhaps as early as the end of next year in reality, with a nefarious non-government actor deciding to act against a satellite. And the first stage of this scenario, you pointed out, could play out in New Zealand. Let's go into that for a little bit, shall we?
It's not just the very large players such as NASA who have the capacity to reach orbit,
as we've been discovering.
And there are some very fine organisations and companies around the world who can launch rockets into orbit. And it turns out that in New Zealand, there is one of them, Rocket Lab. It's actually an American company, but based in New Zealand for the most part.
Whereabouts?
Their headquarters in Auckland.
In Auckland,
They launch their rockets from the Mahai Peninsula, about halfway between Napier and Gisborne on the east coast of North Island.
Gotcha, okay.
So Rocket Lab are a commercial launch organisation. It could be possible for a customer to come to Rocket Lab and say, I would like to launch a satellite into orbit, a small spacecraft up to 150 or 200 kilograms, so something the size of a washing machine. And in good faith, Rocket Lab could launch that satellite.
And what sort of permissions? Like, are there international, let's go back to what we've learned about space law, are there international permissions that Rocket Lab, say, would have to acquire internationally before launching said customer's payload?
So Rocket Lab requires the permission of the FAA, in the US and also the New Zealand government. Imagine there was an Australian organisation such as my team, which is launching a pair of satellites on Rocket Lab in February next year. We also need the permission of the New Zealand government, but we need the permission of the Australian government. So in theory,
just
everything
quickly,
should
the
be fine.
FAA, just tell us who they are. Remind us the FAA is.
I'm sorry. So the Federal Aviation Authority in the US. So they are the.
That's like our CASA.
Correct.
They give it the tick off. Perhaps the people pressing the buttons on that little peninsula on the North Island of New Zealand don't ask too many questions and something is in space, but the intentions of our said nameless customer are slightly more devious and it is something to do with the commercial advantage over a rival. This is the scenario we're painting here.
Yeah, and I should stress, no slight to Rocket Lab, and they do ask all the questions, but just imagine something slipped through.
Sure. They're only human after all.
These days it's possible for commercial players or for organisations all around the world to access space and to get substantial spacecraft into orbit, potentially beyond the control of governments. And those spacecraft increasingly have technological capabilities to be able to be somewhat manoeuvrable and to sneak up on other people's satellites.
And be disrupting, let's say.
And be disrupting. So there's, this approach is being used for good in an effort by several players around the world to be servicing existing satellites to fill up their fuel tanks, to prolong their life in orbit, which is a great thing. But it's also possible to get up to nefarious activities. So imagine we project forwards, potentially even some decades, when Australia may be part of a coalition that is involved in lunar activity, possibly Martian activity. There's a lot of talk about setting up bases on the moon as a stepping stone to bases on Mars. There's talk about off-Earth mining, utilising the resources that are out there on the moon and asteroids and so on. And whatever one might think from an ethical and code of conduct perspective about whether we should do that or not, let's imagine that we do that and that Australia is part of such a coalition. You would think then that within the realm of Australia's national security, national interests, to be part of the protection of those activities, even though they're no longer on Earth. Mm-hmm. Imagine we're part of an international coalition that, for the most part, doesn't involve astronauts in orbit, because human spaceflight is a very, very dangerous and expensive thing to do. Far more easy and far more effective to be flying robots, and that's not science fiction. That's the near-term future. Well, imagine that future scenario involves autonomous systems where Australia is contributing our expertise in remote operations in the resources sector, for example, and we are actively pursuing that for space now. Then it could be that the Australian Defence Force of the future with space technology.
I was hoping you were going to lead to that. Go on.
Perhaps we find ourselves part of an effort to counter a threat from a nefarious actor trying to disrupt.
Say this satellite that they're wishing to install, say a rival satellite to the corporation whose equipment they have damaged or taken offline or whatever, and an international situation is created, would it be our hardware? Would it be our Tidbinbilla or our parks or anything like that? Would it be our intellectual prowess? Would it be our space knowledge that would it be immediately brought to the fore to resolve this situation? Would we be called upon by the big prime players? Look, we need you, just like they did in 1968. We've all seen The Dish. Are we more equipped today to handle assisting with a situation like this than we were back then, Russell?
In some ways, we are more equipped. Let's consider the obvious communication issue in the famous movie The Dish. Mm-hmm. We used our capabilities at parks and also just outside Canberra at Honeysuckle Creek for communication with the astronauts on the moon. The Dish at Tibimbilla, just outside Canberra, the very big dish, is one third of NASA's global deep space network. So if there's any lunar or Martian or other activity in the future, Australia will definitely be involved in that, hopefully not just with radio capabilities, but in the future with laser capabilities for optical communication. So that's one aspect of the way we would be participating in solving the sort of challenging scenario we described. But we now bring to bear capabilities from left field. I mentioned our remote asset management capabilities from the resources sector. Australia has the two largest mining companies in the world, and those companies and others in Australia have led the way in developing robotic remote operations in very, very nasty, challenging environments. We are well equipped to firstly contribute to the development of technologies to do that in space, and not just mining in space, but in general, remote operations of autonomous systems. But if something went wrong and we needed to troubleshoot, we needed to come up with solutions to a very challenging problem in rapid time, it may be that we are amongst the best equipped in the world to draw upon our experience and come up with those solutions in time of crisis.
This is painting a very rosy picture. I often like to ask my guests if they are optimistic or pessimistic about, particularly about an Australian space future. I think I'll put you in the latter camp, which is great to hear, Russell. This is a scenario far removed from that lost industry that we talked, that we alluded to before, after the heyday of Woomera. As an educator, are you seeing the interest in space on a real level, beyond just the sort of rocket ships and dinosaurs coming up from young people who will be our space players of the future? I actually want to quote from the descriptions of one of your educational platforms directly, if I may. The space missions will be underpinned with world-leading ground-based experimental research employing space test chambers, advanced diagnostics, and supercomputer simulations. And this is all happening in Australia, Russell.
It is. And the fact that we are setting out to not just use space-derived data, but to get our hands dirty with satellites and in turn to train others, particularly in the Defence Force, the art of space missions, of satellite development, using the educational tools that we've developed here, tools for analysing orbits, world-class tools for designing missions and satellites. The fact that we're doing that is very important. And we're seeing a lot of focus coming onto our group and the efforts here at the Australian Defence Force Academy. And we're engaged in a lot of conversations, particularly with young people, particularly with those in the rapidly growing startup sector in Australia. And in fact, it's the largest. Australia has the largest rate of establishment of startups in space of any country in the world.
Australia has the largest, just say that again, because that does astonish me and it delights me too. Just repeat that, Russell, so I can hear it again.
Australia has the largest rate of establishment of space startups of any country in the world. I've lost track of the numbers this year. We're well over 100 startups. It's probably many more than that now.
And these are small concerns, every concern starts small, of people getting together with a brilliant idea of how we can interact in this country with space, put it in the most simplest terms.
Correct. Some of those ideas, some of those startups will fail because that's just the nature of
all startups.
Being an entrepreneur.
Yes.
On the other hand, some of them are clearly succeeding, and there's a handful of examples in Australia of small companies that are starting to get significant traction and growing at a rapid rate.
In what sort of areas, may I ask, is the real international interest being directed to? What is the nature of our space interaction that is grabbing that attention? Is that a satellite manufacturer, launch systems?
Yes and yes and yes. I'll give you a couple of examples. In the increasingly important field of Internet of Things, there are at least two very successful companies in Australia. One is called Myriota, the other is called Fleet, and they are coming at the Internet of Things employing space technology from slightly different directions, and they're both proving to be successful. There are small companies who are developing downstream applications, turning satellite, particularly imagery data, into information to solve problems. There are companies starting up in Australia to develop for the needs of defence, for example, ISR capabilities, intelligence, surveillance and reconnaissance. There are launch capabilities developing. We'll see whether any of those are ultimately successful. There will be significant commercial forces acting against them because they'll be competing globally. But the rate of establishment of these companies is astonishing. The reason I brought this up is that those particularly young people starting those companies, they recognise the skill sets that they need. They recognise the need for education and experience. And the work that my group and others around the country are doing to firstly gain experience ourselves and seek to transfer that experience and that know-how via education into the hands of these young people is extremely important.
What a wonderful note, I think, to round out the discussion. I love that optimism that you present, Russell. It's good to know that in your esteemed opinion, we do have a strong Australian space future if we get things right, if we continue to get the societal and governmental and commercial support that something like a space industry in a country such of ours must surely need.
Absolutely. I am very optimistic. I do caution that Australia should not just blindly shotgun style throw money at industry at large in the hope that we will grow enough companies to take our claimed fair share of the global space economy in proportion to our GDP share of the global economy. I don't think it works that way. We've got to be cleverer than that, and we've got to put the money at the areas of activity where Australia can truly lead, where we're not fighting against highly motivated incumbents in the global space sector, but we're creating those the new areas of the market ourselves.
Russell, what you've just told me about Australia's importance in the global sphere, I had no idea the importance of Tidbinbilla and Honeysuckle Creek in the ACT. Just remind us what proportion you said of America's, was it their deep space program is provided by us?
NASA's Deep Space Network, so the communication network that enables comms with spacecraft traveling towards the sun or to Mars or out past Neptune, etc. One third of that network is based just outside of Canberra at Tidbinbilla. In the Apollo days, it was Honeysuckle Creek and also Parkes, but these days the communications is at Tidbinbilla. It includes some of the assets that were at Honeysuckle Creek, but plenty more. And in fact, just to make a link for you with space situational awareness is usually thought to be trying to understand potential collisions between space objects, between satellites. But in actual fact, another form of collision is between an asteroid and the Earth. And so there's a lot of effort made to track near-Earth objects, asteroids that come uncomfortably close to the Earth. In the recent years, my group worked with CSIRO and DST and NASA's JPL in some research where the Big Dish at Tidbinbilla and the Big Dish at Parkes were turned into a radar system.
Right.
radar waves were transmitted from the Big Dish at Tidbinbilla, aimed at, or firstly at the moon to calibrate them, but then when it was used in anger, aimed at a passing asteroid.
Yes.
And the reflected waves collected by the dish at Parkes and were used to characterize the trajectory and, with advanced signal processing, even extract information about the behavior of the asteroid in terms of rotation and so on.
And where was this asteroid? How close was it coming to us?
Well, it was well outside the orbit of the moon, so it wasn't close.
Right.
But
that's close enough for me, I have to say.
Occasionally, big objects do pass between the Earth and the moon. I know that there is one coming seriously close sometime in the next decade.
Right.
Which space scientists are very excited about.
You're just telling me this others. Now, Russell. Now you've got me worried. Is there a name or a number? Maybe it could be the Russell Boyce 260 or something like that. You have it named after yourself.
I believe it does have a name. I don't know what it is. I'm certain it's not named after me. But this is part of, well, what an incredible universe and what an incredible world we live in, and how cool is it that we're capable of asking questions and seeking answers and stretching to be better and better as a human species. What we've talked about today is just various examples of that. It's quite exciting.
Very, very cool, Russell. I fully agree with you there. I can see you're going to be very busy over the next few years, Russell, but space education has to start earlier, surely, than the postgraduate tertiary sector. Am I right? What's been done with younger children, particularly in regional areas of Australia?
Well, Michael, let me give you two examples, and you're dead right. It's got to start with younger people, and the young kids in the regions are just as talented as the ones in the cities, possibly more open-minded. Some years ago, there was under a thing called the Australian Space Research Program, an excellent program was funded called the Mars Yard, at Powerhouse Museum, and part of the funding of that, including support from NBN, was to be able to pipe Mars landscape and remote operation of rovers and analysis of Martian imagery from NASA to support real research. That was piped through the internet to regional schools to very, very good effect. So that's one example. As another example, another one of the hats that I wear, I'm the chair of COSPAR 2021, which will be the world's largest space research conference ever. COSPAR is the Committee for Space Research. It was set up in the 60s, I think, the international peaceful counterpart to the US-Soviet space race.
Mm-hmm.
Every 2 years they have this ginormous conference. It's never been to our part of the world ever.
I see.
Despite COVID, we're seeking to add value and leave a significant STEM legacy through a space STEM park on site in Darling Harbour, virtualized, so that we will be able to pipe particularly out to the regions and particularly with the support of the New South Wales Department of Education, which in turn I learnt recently has the second largest school jurisdiction in the world. That's an aside. We'll be piping a space journey with virtualized hands-on education opportunities for teachers and school kids to schools across New South Wales, at least, potentially all of Australia and potentially even globally. It's a very, very important thing to be doing, and we're seeking to do it and to hopefully start a tidal wave.
Wow. Sounds very exciting. Space future for young people in very good and safe and creative hands. And if I may stick a feather in our Conversations on the Runway cap, I believe the curator of the aforementioned Mars exhibition that you so described, Russell, at Powerhouse, was done by one of our previous guests here on the show, Kerry Doherty, who you no doubt know.
I do know Kerry. Kerry was involved, and a partner in crime of hers, Carol Oliver, from my university, but in Sydney, was the lead for that.
We'll grab her for our next series. Don't you worry about that. No one on Conversations on the Runway who knows anything about space gets out of here alive. Professor Russell Boyce, it's been absolutely wonderful talking to you today about Australia's future in space, what we're doing, where we're heading. I really like the tone of your optimism. If you were the boss of everything in, say, 20 years' time, if there's one thing that we could have established, what would make you very happy to see it in this country space-wise?
I would like to see, and in fact, I'm attempting to make a start on it, I would like to see a national program developed for students, for at least secondary students, high school students and university students, to get their hands dirty in space activity. So something like a national innovation challenge for space, but one that is designed a little bit differently to what the rest of the world might do, where they have competitions for space missions for students. It's not realistic that a future Australian space economy is manufacturing hundreds of thousands of satellites. The market's simply not there and never will be.
Mm-hmm.
What is realistic is very, very large numbers of highly skilled future workers turning data into information from space systems, engaged in developing artificial intelligence systems. So I can see the opportunity for a national program that offers a small amount of hands-on space hardware experience, but more importantly, a large amount of opportunity for students to create algorithms, artificial intelligence capabilities, upload them to satellites, turn data into information on the satellites, and become directly connected into the real opportunity for Australia that lies ahead.
What a terrific aim to work for. Professor Russell Boyce of the University of New South Wales, Canberra, thanks so much for your time and your expertise today on Conversations on the Runway, our final episode, all on space.
You've been listening to Conversations on the Runway, and we've been exploring key areas within air and space power. All views expressed by our podcast guests are their personal views and do not represent those of the Australian Air Force or the Department of Defence. Conversations on the Runway is brought to you by the Australian Air Force. Executive producer is Squadron Leader Kath Kennedy of the School of Postgraduate Studies. Sharpen your intellectual edge on Australia's air and space power by going to www.runway.airforce.gov.au.